Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 19th, 2006. Our session today is titled Moral Values for Voters. Our presenter is John Marty. Let's listen in.
Was used as moral values voters. It's a talk about how religion and values were viewed by candidates and pundits in the 2004 election and how what the impact was on the outcome and how they're likely to be viewed in 2006. I'm John Marty and a member of the State Senate in Minnesota, and this is one of many trips we've made to Holden, so glad to be here. And to start by where things were in 2004 election, a year before the election, Pew Research Center did a poll on moral values voting, and their way of determining who were the moral values voters were to indicate who attended church at least on a weekly basis versus those who seldom or never attend. And the numbers here, and there are other polls that define this differently, but they tested for those who had attended at least weekly church. They found voted Republican 63-37, so they were breaking it down by church attendance versus partisan affiliation, 63-37%. And those who seldom or never attended church voted Democratic 62-38%, which again is not, church attendance is not an indication of moral values by any means, but that's the indicator they used. And there were other ways people did. Do you consider yourself to be a moral values voter? There were a number of polls taken after the election. And but the point was, there was very heavy tilt of people who considered themselves moral values voters, religious voters, or others compared to the rest of the public. And given that 85% of American people, I think it is, consider themselves to be Christian, and 90-some percent consider themselves to be believers of some religion or another, it certainly has an impact. I mean, most people would see themselves as people of faith, but when they broke it down to how they determined and how others determined who were the moral values voters, obviously some people who may have moral values and may vote based on those values didn't consider them as such, and the media didn't consider it that way. So the whole assumption was that certain people who tended to be members of the Christian right were people who were moral values voters, and they voted on moral values as opposed to everyone else. And Jim Wallace, who's an evangelical Christian editor of Sojourners magazine, this is a year before the 2004 election, he explained it, and I'm going to quote him here. President Bush and the Republicans clearly have an advantage with people of faith. They are more comfortable talking about religious values and issues, and they promise that their faith will affect their policies. He said, President Bush is as public and expressive about his faith as any recent occupant of the White House. He says the Democratic candidates seem uncomfortable with the subject of religion. Quote, they stumble all over themselves to assure voters that while they may be people of faith, they won't allow their religious beliefs to affect their political views. For too many Democrats, faith is private, has no implications for political life. But what kind of faith is that? Where would America be if Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King had kept his faith to himself? And he used his Howard Dean, who was at that time the front runner for the Democratic nomination, is an example of what he called the Democrats' problem. He said Dr. Dean recently explained his faith did not inform his politics. He said the presidential race should stay away from the issues of guns, God, and gays, focus on jobs, health care, and foreign policy. And Jim Wallace argues that by framing the issue this way, declining to talk about overtly religious topics or, quote, moral issues, it allows the other side to frame the terms of the debate. And in politics, more and more people are recognizing how you frame the debate determines who wins the debate. And he said because of that decision of Democratic candidates, and John Kerry certainly followed that tradition, he said the religious issues in the election will be reduced to the Ten Commandments in public courthouses, to marriage amendments, to prayer in schools, and of course abortion. A side note to that is the columnist E.J. DeYoung once said, well, you know, if they want to put the Ten Commandments there, how come there's nobody pressing to have Christ's actual words put somewhere? Like he said, how about the Beatitudes on public property? He said, maybe the answer to that is if we put blessed are the merciful in a courtroom, They'd say he's soft on crime if we put something of blessed at the peacemakers at the Pentagon. Now, that would be heresy, he said. That might too. We just want to print them everywhere to show it. Anyway, finally, Wallace also argued that the failure of Democrats to talk in terms of moral issues is a major political miscalculation. And he argued, and I think correctly so, that it doesn't just affect their standing with the so-called religious voters, but not just the hardcore Christian right voters, but also with other folks, including non-religious people alike. And I think that is the case. The public, in my mind, wants to support people who believe in something. And to people who, what do you stand for? Oh, don't worry, I'm not going to use my religious beliefs on anything. Why are you going to make decisions? Well, I don't know. But I think he is right that failure to talk about those things lets the other side decide them. And because of that, the issues did become very heavily abortion, which has been a factor for 30 years straight. Gay marriage became a very hot topic last time. And many people would argue, people from all, political analysts from all over the spectrum, and I think the public in general believes that these so-called moral values voters did determine the outcome of the election. They did provide perhaps the biggest single factor in Bush's victory, and the conservative right-wing Christian Republican victories in Congress. And what's the impact on the issues? It's obviously going to have an impact on social issues, abortion, gay marriage, but it also has an impact on virtually every other issue. Perhaps you've seen the button, the Christian right is neither, meaning it's... and it's the other issues, many of which I think many of us would consider moral issues. The spin on them that the Christian rights politicians and religious leaders have points of view that I think many of us would see as anti or antithetical to the moral values taught by Christ. I'll just give a couple of quick examples of them. The religious leaders and political leaders who have determined that the lives of Iraqi civilians are less important than American soldiers, which is understandable. Some may feel that way because these folks are from our country and they're giving their lives for us. But to avoid weakening support for the war, they refuse to even count the Iraqi civilians. In the past, I think it's been a thing, you try and count how many people have been killed. Here we weren't going to even talk about them. And if somebody wants to say, well, the reason they did that is because they want to really focus on the sacrifice American soldiers have given, well, if that's really the case, then why would they? We actually had a national federal government policy that they were going to prohibit media photographers from photographing American corpses in flag-draped coffins coming home, which is not the way you honor somebody. It's, we don't want anyone to see the picture of their corpse coming home, of their casket coming home. But they didn't want that. We have these same political leaders deciding to reclassify prisoners of war as, I think they call them, non-enemy combatants, and then they can use torture, forms of torture, saying that Geneva Convention rules do not apply because they're not prisoner of war, they're enemy combatants, whatever the difference is. You get the point where one Marine Corps general, James Mattis, said about the firefights in Iraq, this is a quote, "It's fun to shoot some people. You got guys who ain't got no manhood left anyhow, so it's a hell of a lot of fun to shoot them." And there's a evangelical Christian magazine, World, a Lutheran columnist in there, Gene Edward Veith, I don't know anything about him, he defended this Mattis's comments about the fun of shooting and killing. He said, quote, "There's pleasure in battle, excitement, exhilaration, and fierce joy go along with the combat." He wants people to view the issue from a, quote, Christian perspective. And he said that the work of a soldier is killing people, and, quote, "There's nothing wrong with enjoying one's work." I don't think I have to say why I think that many of us would see that as antithetical to the Christian message. But it's not just on military policy, it's also on economic policy as well. Last winter, U.S. Congress, which our state legislature and most states are doing similar things, voted fairly significant cuts in the medical assistance or Medicaid program, health care for the poor, and when we have Christ who was a healer of the sick. Deep cuts in the food stamp program, we're told to feed the hungry. We have additional tax cuts, which were the reason for a lot of these cuts, going primarily to those of the high end, and Christ didn't really call for us to give more to the wealthy. I don't know who gave me this, but it was a Mad Magazine satire, the Bush campaign's TV commercial, if he was running against Jesus. Picture of one picture of a version of Christ. Jesus of Nazareth says, give to him who begs from you and do not refuse to him who would borrow from you. The cut line underneath. Jesus favors a government handouts for welfare cheats. Next frame. Jesus of Nazareth says, judge not that you not be judged. Jesus is soft on crime. Jesus of Nazareth says, render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's. Jesus will raise your taxes. Jesus of Nazareth says, do not resist one who is evil, but if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn himself to the other. Can we trust Jesus to fight the war on terror? Jesus, wrong on social services, wrong on crime, wrong on defense, wrong for America. And Mad Magazine, in its good satire, says, I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this message. But we have an extreme view that I think many would consider unchristian. You get the people, the Pat Robertsons. And again, I would merge together the political and the religious leaders of the so-called Christian right movement. And you get Pat Robertson, who last year advocated the assassination of Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela. He said something like, if he thinks we're trying to assassinate him, I think we really ought to go ahead and do it. It's a whole lot cheaper than starting a war, and I don't think any oil shipments will stop. Again, the priorities are the oil shipments and the money, not what's right or wrong. And moral value voters, as they've been defined, did win the election. They elected a president who says his favorite philosopher is Jesus Christ. They've elected a very supportive Christian right Congress. And ever since that time, we've come to the point where I, as a politician who's not on that wing of the spectrum, and many of my colleagues and political pundits and mainstream voters who didn't agree with that agenda have been saying, how can we take back the country? How can we take back, how can we win these moral value voters? And I've seen all sorts of analysis of how the best ways to do this. Some of them are very contrived. I heard one politician advise others, go to church more often and make sure you insert mentions of your religious beliefs as often as you can. And that's a bit contrived, and I think that kind of backfires when somebody's trying to do something that may be artificial. And it's a little insulting. When I saw it, I thought it was pretty insulting that somebody's telling you you should choose your religious habits based on your desire to get votes in elections. Some of the suggestions were thoughtful. I think the biggest one I've seen is expand the discussion of morality. It's the most obvious one. Beyond the hot-button social issues like abortion and gay marriage to other issues. If you frame the moral values to include concern for the poor, the sick, the elderly, opposition to preemptive war, fair tax policy, protection of the environment, stewardship of our planet. I think there's a lot of people can understand that those could be seen as moral values. And a lot of the public, I think the mainstream public, really does see them as moral values as well. The media is a little slower to pick up on that, partly because it's simpler. If you can say, hey, here who are we going to quote on religious perspective, Pat Robertson, Jim Dobson, Jerry Falwell, the handful of people they've used for years. And so when people like Jim Wallace from Sojourner started speaking out on poverty issues, they had a poverty, anti-poverty tour last year, 2 years ago, the media didn't know how to take them on because they said they were religious people too, and they had a whole different set of agenda, a whole different range of issues. And I do think that that's is one who sees most issues we deal with is moral choices. Our tax policies are very much, who are we collecting money from to fund, what should we fund? Those are very, I mean, government makes choices for society, and that's why in a democracy we elect a government who we hope will make wise choices for us. I think people, myself included, see those as moral issues, and the suggestions are you ought to talk about that some, that they are moral issues. But I'd say the other part of it that's a big mistake of what happened in 2004 and so on is a lot of people who don't consider themselves Christian right, a lot of politicians feel, but then we better not talk about those issues like abortion and gay marriage because, you know, they're losing issues. You're going to lose a lot more votes on them than you can possibly gain. And I think that's a bit naive to say when you've got this group of voters, and I don't know if it's 20% of the population, it was more than that in some of the polls on who considered themselves to be moral values voters. When you have a majority of them, I would say the vast majority of those moral values voters, as they've been defined, would say the number one issue to them is abortion. And so if you refuse to talk about the most important issue, oh, let's talk about other issues. I don't think you don't even start a conversation. Why should we? I would argue that in the last campaign, a lot of people who, when George Bush was criticized for something, not being honest about the war or something else, well, they knew he was good on the issue they care about, on abortion, and therefore he was a saintly person, and anybody who would criticize him must be on the other side. They were the dark side, the evil people, and so even when there's some wrongdoing going on, well, it can't be right. That's just the media making it up, because we know he's the good guy on the right issue. And conservative political commentators in the media in general have accepted the notion that anyone who cares about morality is what, and I'm going to use the terms that the public generally uses, the media uses, politicians use, pro-life versus pro-choice. They've accepted that you are pro-life on the abortion issue. And it's not surprising and it's not new, but if it's becoming increasingly problematic for people on the pro-choice side of the issue, because for the last 20 years we're getting more and more of these people who are moral values voters who are going to talk about that issue. If you're scared to talk about it, you're not going to have any discussion. And I've never seen myself as either pro-abortion or anti-life. I believe abortion should be safe, legal, and I think it was Bill Clinton who said, and rare. But I think there are many people, mainstream people, I don't want to get into this, is it 60-40% who are pro-choice versus pro-life, or 40-60 pro-choice, pro-life, however you break it down. I don't think most people in the country see themselves as one, they may see themselves as one or the other, but when you discuss the issue, I don't think most people who consider themselves pro-life think that you should make abortion illegal in all cases. George Bush Sr. was in this debate, some of you may remember, with Michael Dukakis close to 20 years ago now, in which it was a media questions of them, and they asked, pinned down Bush, well, if you think abortion should be illegal, do you arrest the women? No, they're the victims. Well, who do you arrest then? If it's a crime, if it's murder, who do you arrest? The doctor? Yeah, you arrest the doctor. Jim Baker, I think it was, whoever Bush's campaign manager at the time was in the press room giving the spin on that, saying that's not what he meant. I mean, the campaign manager saying what the candidate said isn't what he meant before he even has a chance to check with the candidate to find out where the candidate went. Because, of course, you couldn't do that, because I don't think Bush would want them arrested. I don't think most of the American public would. Most people who consider themselves pro-life on the abortion issue think abortion is wrong. So how do you express your opposition to something? To say it's wrong? Well, maybe we should make it illegal. I heard one person say that, somebody who had talked with some of the, a lot of the faculty at Notre Dame are priests, and a lot of them are, the younger ones are seen as counselors by young students who had young couples come in and say, Father, you know, we feel terrible about this, but she got pregnant, and you know, it would have wrecked both of our college careers, and it would have just destroyed our lives, so we feel terrible about this, but she had an abortion. What do we do? Should we get involved in the pro-life movement to it's penance almost. I mean, which is what they want to do is express that this is not a good solution and it's not something they like. But it's become to the point where the political argument is either you're in favor of abortion or you want to stop it, make it illegal across the board. And I don't think most people see it that way. There are certainly some people who think aborting a 8-week-old fetus is same thing as shooting a 8-year-old in the head. Very few. I think it might be 0.5% of the population. There's another small percentage who feels that abortion is just a piece of tissue. A fetus is just a piece of tissue, and there's no moral implication of it whatsoever. I think most of us believe it's more than that, and it's more significant than that. And I, among others, dropped in a bill a couple of years ago. It has gone nowhere, but that would have, I'd argue, single-handedly reduced the number of abortions in Minnesota by far more than all the restrictions that have been passed by the anti-abortion movement in the last 30 years. How would it do it? Well, first of all, it would provide access to family planning services across the state to anyone who needed them. Affordability was not to be a concern, but if you are trying to prevent the pregnancy, we're going to make sure you have the resources to do so. And when most counties in Minnesota have zero family planning clinic available, they can get services, but in another county. The other part of it was comprehensive sexuality education, which does work. The numbers from California and other states where have tried family planning services expansion, they can actually calculate how many, just using statistical analysis of what it is, how many million dollars, how many pregnancies are prevented, how many abortions are prevented for every $1 million of family planning services. You can calculate it out. It would prevent unintended pregnancies, it prevent abortions. And again, I'm not pro-abortion, absolutely not. And I'm confident and I'm willing to talk with people who consider themselves pro-life voters because, again, most of them don't really want to make it illegal. They want to make it unnecessary. And they don't want somebody to just flippantly say, oh, I'll go have another abortion, which undoubtedly there are people who treat it that way. But again, I think a whole lot of people, if you can engage them on a discussion, I think people are willing to talk about it. They're willing to go somewhere. And they're willing to listen. But instead, when there's only one side of the debate, oh, do you like abortion? No. But then vote for this candidate. And I'm convinced that Karl Rove and some of the political operatives of the Christian right do not want the abortion issue resolved. To tie it in with the gay marriage issue, which I'll get to in a second, this year they had to run an amendment proposal up the flagpole in Congress so they could get a vote to prove who was on which side of the issue. Well, we've now had Ronald Reagan for 8 years and George Herbert Walker Bush for 4 years and George W. Bush for 5 years, 6 years, six years now. And in all those 20-some years, how many times have they tried to make abortion illegal? Well, we're waiting until we get a new Supreme Court. Well, how come you don't need a new Supreme Court? All you need to do is amend the Constitution. They might lose, but how many times have they tried? Not even once, because I think they're afraid. You don't want the issue to go away if it's bringing you a lot of support. And I happen to believe that a lot of people who consider themselves pro-lifers would be people who are more interested in seeing a resolution to the issue than one who are trying to score political points on it. And I would argue, as one who is not take the abortion should be illegal point of view, that the other side has used it very effectively to gain growing numbers of, quote, moral value voters, and that people ought to talk openly about it. The other big issue, and I don't think it's any, this past year or 2 years ago may have been as big of an issue as abortion, was the gay marriage issue. And again, this year in Minnesota, we've had it up for about 3-4 years now, and it's as hot of an issue as you can get. The legislature, the House passed it 3, 4, 5 times to make sure everybody knew they really wanted to put it on the ballot. Senate did not. We defeated it in committee, and attempts to bring it up on the floor kept coming back over and over and over again anytime they could until recently, which makes me think that they realized public opinion is changing on the issue. But most of my colleagues who, and it's a hot issue, I've had an opponent, I'm up for election this November, and I've had an opponent for over 2 years now because of my view on that issue. He's running because I'm opposing the constitutional amendment on gay marriage. And most of my colleagues have a different perspective on it. Most of them, I would argue, vast majority of both parties don't think it's a good idea to put this in the Constitution. A whole lot of them don't think it should be illegal even, but, you know, it's a hot political issue, and they know how to score political points. And so it's become a very partisan thing in Minnesota. The Democrats are opposing it, but they're not going to say we favor gay marriage. We don't need it. We've got a law. We had a law basically implying that it had to be a one man and one woman to get married, opposite gender. But in 1997, there was a move to explicitly spell out that marriage is between one man and one woman, to restate the law just to make the point and to score political points. And 1997, I think there were only six of us in our state senate who voted against that. But unlike the other members of my caucus who are opposed to it, their response has always been, again, it's a sort of a duck on the issue. Well, no, we don't favor gay marriage, but we don't think it should be on the Constitution because it's not necessary. It's not necessary. It's already in law. And we shouldn't put things that big in the Constitution or whatever. And in the end, it sort of starts to the, quote, moral values voter, to the public at large, is there's something wrong with gay marriage. You know, if both sides are saying, well, we don't want it in the Constitution, or we do want it in the Constitution, but the side that's saying we don't want it in the Constitution is saying, because it's unnecessary, then the other side keeps going ahead and say, well, what if that law gets overturned? What if this happens? And in effect, both sides are saying, yeah, it's either bad and so we should ban it in the Constitution, or it's bad, but we don't want it in the Constitution. And it basically cedes the argument to the other side that it's a bad thing in some way or shape or form. It's unacceptable, it's immoral, it's something wrong about it. And I think, again, the issue and the way I feel you address moral values voters is to educate people, to talk about them and talk about it in an open way. You might actually succeed in educating somebody, and even if it doesn't educate somebody, at least you're letting people know that there are two sides to the issue. I talk about, my argument has always been, as a father who's happily married for 25 years now, I've never seen how somebody else's marriage is going to have an impact, how a single same-sex marriage is going to have any impact on my marriage, or how it's going to have any impact on anybody's marriage, or any marriage, whether it's same-sex or opposite-sex, how it's going to have an impact on somebody else's marriage. I've said when they start saying, well, let us vote, because our constitutional amendments are approved by voters, let us vote. And I've argued we all ought to have a vote on marriage. I agree with them on that. My wife and I voted to marry each other, and it was nobody else's business, but at least we were able to choose who we wanted to choose. And nobody else chose whether we could or not, and I don't think I should have a say in whether somebody else can or not. But again, despite all the anti-gay marriage rhetoric, I was making the argument, I've never yet heard a cogent argument on how it's harmful if we do that. It's, well, if this happens, then marriage is going to fall apart. People are going to get divorced, all kinds of bad things will happen if we allow gay marriage, things that aren't happening now. And but not really a cogent argument that any debate, high school debate club would say, that was a good argument, that was a powerful argument. And instead of saying, well, I don't think it's necessary, or, well, let's kind of avoid the issue, I suggest that my Christian faith is one that encourages affirming committed relationships. And whereas some people find a few verses in the Bible that I would argue they interpret in a very strange way, not the way I would interpret them, but that's their religious belief, their right to do that. But for every verse they have on that, I see many verses that very clearly speak to the importance of love and commitment. And I see marriage as something that's good and pleasing to God and therefore ought to be something we ought to affirm. And in doing so, I think I've noticed this year, I've written a piece in the paper on why my religious belief said we shouldn't just not put it in the Constitution, a ban on it, but we should legalize it. And during the debate in our Judiciary Committee, one of the other side folks said, after he heard the opponent's testimony and my comments on this, he said, you know, Senator Marty, it sounds like you and some of these opponents, you're not just, I'm hearing two arguments. One is that it shouldn't be in the Constitution because it's unnecessary. And then on the other hand, you guys are sort of saying we ought to legalize it. And I was going to say, I think that he's on to something. Maybe we ought to talk about the fact that there are people of religious views who are on both sides of the issues. And then do we want this to be, should government be deciding which people a church can marry and which ones they can't? I think there's very few things government can do that's more intrusive than tell a church who they can marry and who they can't marry. But I think it's a matter of reframing the debate in a way that I think in Minnesota in the last, I don't know about the rest of the country, but in the last 6, 8, 10 months, I think there's been a major change in public opinion to the point that the woman who offered the amendment, the lead person on this thing who's running for Congress right now, last 2 years ago, she was the last night of session offering any chance she could, she'd trying to bring a point of order somehow or another to get attention so she could raise her issue again. This year, session ended, everybody's waiting for her to bring it up again and again and again. Not once did she try and bring it up on the floor that I can recall. And why? I think she was beginning to realize this is beginning to backfire on us. And it's partly because religious community, there was a Minnesota Pastor Summit a year ago in which the whole point of it was to strategize on how we could pass this into the Constitution. And other people of faith started coming together and having other rallies and other points on it. And all of a sudden it became clear to most people, including the media, that there are people of, it was a religious debate between one group of Christians largely and other groups of Christians in other faiths who felt the other way about it. And so again, I think by taking on an issue up front, you do change thinking on it. And as part of that, I don't think it's so much the politicians who have been changing it, it's others. The politicians, the political consultants, not just on gay marriage, but all these issues, they say, well, they're the ones who encourage you to, in politics, you don't want to offend anybody because they're going to vote against you if you offend them. So don't offend anybody, so don't talk about a controversial issue. They work on ways to word things more wisely, which is smart. They work on ways to change the subject, which is just one other way of ducking the issue. But there are a whole lot of other people, religious leaders who are speaking out, again, getting back to the gay marriage issue, religious leaders, people in committed relationships. One little story about how words make a difference in how taking on an issue. I had a group of people who were fighting against the constitutional amendment come into my office a couple years ago, right before we voted on, I was on the Judiciary Committee where we voted on it, and it was a swing vote. I guess every member is a swing vote when it's defeated by one vote. But they were saying, what can we do? They knew where I stood on it. What can we do to help? What can we do to be supportive? We know you're getting a lot of nasty stuff. And I said, well, think about the language you use. I said, how I know a lot of same-sex couples that have had, are living in committed relationships, and they've had commitment ceremonies or services in their churches. And I said, my wife and I had a commitment ceremony 20-some years ago, and we called ours a marriage. And that, and again, this is the hot part of it, because a lot of people, the majority of Americans, I think, feel we should give equal rights to same-sex couples, but let's not use the word marriage. And that's fine. I don't care what people want to call something. My point was that the woman who's carrying this bill to put in the Constitution would never call it a marriage. She'd call it an abomination or whatever she wants. But again, should she be dictating what I call my relationship a marriage? And I'm not telling anybody else to, but I suggested to this group that maybe if somebody had been in the same, had a commitment ceremony, maybe they were married. And I'm not trying to tell them how to phrase their terminology, but that they should choose what they call their partnership, not somebody else. It was interesting, about 2 or 3 minutes later, I took some other questions, and this woman in the back of the room raised her hand and said, Senator Murray, we were listening to, my partner and I were just discussing what you said a few minutes ago, and we had a commitment ceremony ourselves 22 years ago or something. And we had a commitment ceremony ourselves. And we were just thinking that maybe we've been married all this time. It was really, you couldn't have set it up better, but somebody had given me flowers that morning. I grabbed the flowers and said, "Can I be the first to congratulate you on 22 years of marriage?" And but the point with it is I hear most of the people on my side of that issue say, "Well, we've fought that off. Now we can talk about civil unions or something else." I always think of that as something like separate but equal. We're not going to call it this. We're going to say it's the same thing, but we're not going to call it that. I'm thinking that what you do is you try and discuss things in a way that, you know, I think 2 years ago when I started speaking out on this issue when it came up in the Senate, I think it was a very big vote loser for me. I think in my district now, I'm planning on winning. I wouldn't be out here for 2 weeks if I was... if I was panicky about it, maybe worried or concerned about it, but the point is, if you speak to people, if you talk with them, they come around. And I think in the moral values voters are, most of them, the ones who I'd say are truly consider themselves moral values voters are people who are sincere. They want to do the right thing. And if you, one, see which issues are moral issues to other side of a political agenda, and you say, "We're not going to talk about those issues, and, well, let's change the subject, and maybe we'll agree with you on this issue," you don't really have a chance to open it up to them. You don't have a chance to win on it. And again, I think the political consultants are very good, and the political managers are very good at telling you, don't do that. Don't talk about the issues. Duck, change the subject, whatever else you have to do. And my argument is that people sometimes... they may not agree with you. I think I have a lot of constituents who would not agree with me on the gay marriage issue, but who think, well, you know, you make a rational point. It's kind of hard to argue it's irrational to say those things when what you've been believing to this point is that, well, it's going to destroy marriage as we know it if we allow this to happen. So making an argument to them that they can understand, even if they're not sure they're comfortable with it, I think they're, one, more willing to accept it, and two, they're willing to expand their thoughts about what a moral issue is and whether this, there's so much certainty in their mind that what their position is the right one.
What's your take on just the average citizen's ability to have that rational debate in the public setting?
Well, yeah, that's a good one. I'm not sure.
It might be something for you as a senator to be in a debate. And,
right.
But to get citizens together in the 04 election, it was so heated.
Right. And that's the thing. You can't. One citizen isn't going to change it. One politician isn't going to change it. I don't think a church resolution changes any of this. I think a church resolution may be important for its own reasons, but people don't decide. I mean, I had a woman across the street a couple of years ago who hated, thought gays were child molesters. She had young kids, and she sent me when gay rights came up at the legislature 10 years ago, she sent me all this Christian hate literature saying about how, you know, gays are child molesters and this and this, and they're going to attack your kids, and they're going to do this and that. And some of our favorite neighbors live just down the street from us, two houses down from us, and across the street from her, happens to be a gay couple. And she thinks the world of them. They always took care of the senior citizens, snow shoveling and lawn mowing and everything else. They were wonderful people. And I think she figured they were just, quote, roommates. Didn't occur to her they could be gays. Couldn't be gay people because she knew how evil they were. And these two folks weren't evil. And she has since moved away, but I think she caught on before then, and she still likes these guys. And I know because their son also graduated from high school this year, and these neighbors got a card from a graduation announcement. They were sending a gift. So they obviously, she's made some progress. But again, it's not the kind of thing that happens overnight. But the way it happens is not through church resolutions or political statements or things like that. It's because they see the couple in the church pew in front of them on Sunday morning happen to be two women or two men. And they eventually figure out that they're not just roommates, but that they're partners, and they're good people, and they go to church, they go to our church, they do this. In time, that That's what moves people along. And my writing a few columns saying, the reason I wrote it as a politician, not as a religious leader, saying it's my religious beliefs that caused me to actually want to affirm and support gay marriages, is partly because I wasn't seeing a lot of commentary from religious leaders on that. Since then, I think I've seen a lot more. But number two, well, politicians would say, well, it's easy for them to say it. They're so out of touch with the political world. And I think for somebody who's in the middle of the political world to say it might give, I mean, I wrote that mainly not for the public, but for a lot of my colleagues who, well, they know it's immoral, but, you know, they don't personally see anything that wrong with it. And to give them the comfort to know that somebody, person of faith, sees it a little bit differently, and that when they put two and two together, maybe it's okay. But I think the same thing, the public at large, do I think that the public at large who is anti-gay marriage, and the polls still, even in Minnesota, still show that's the case, but it's changing fast, and I don't think we're going to have a constitutional amendment pushed 2 years from now, because I don't think the votes would be there.
The question I have...
Okay. Right.
In the community, whatever the issue, it doesn't matter. Those right. are the issues that
they do. But can we have civil discussions?
At least in, I live in a small community in central Minnesota, and we try to set those up with some boundaries and rules, and people aren't interested, or they're scared, or I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that setting up formal debates or formal community forums is the way you can start and community such as yours necessarily, but you know, discussions over the water cooler at work or over a cup of coffee at the local coffee shop, people, or after church. I mean, people do engage in different ways, and they don't move overnight. I can have a discussion with you, and you and I disagree with each other on the issue of some whatever issue, and I'm not going to tell you something like this, and all of a sudden you're going to, by golly, you're right, I agree with you. It doesn't happen that way, but those little, we do have a lot of civic discourse in this country, not very well organized and not very consistent. And for the public even to be aware of what's going on in politics and to hear both sides of things are very simple. I guess my response would be, if you don't try and talk about it, whether in those formal settings, which are a great idea if you can get them to happen, but if people aren't willing to talk about them, aren't willing to speak out on the issues, you don't have a chance. And basically on the moral values voters, the moral values issues as they've been defined by the media and the political world and therefore the public, we've automatically cut off the debate. There is no debate. And my point is that, hey, if I start explaining my views on the abortion issue, I think there are a lot of people who would find it something they actually agree with, who wouldn't otherwise feel that's a position of logic to them. It's something, not something they supported. And in time, it does change people. It certainly softens up where people stand on things. And the most important thing we have is civil discourse. I mean, when we get to the point where our guys are the saints and their guys are the evil, I mean, what we're doing militarily around the world, what we're doing hating about Islamic fundamentalists, when we have American military people saying how much fun it is to kill these guys. And we had the other general who was saying how our God is bigger than their God and their Islamic whatever, and that's why God has given us this president and this military so we can win this war. When we talk that way, you don't have discourse when you start ratcheting up the rhetoric and the other side is evil. And that's why my argument is one-on-one conversations persuade people, letters to the editor occasionally persuade people. Politicians being willing to say things that may be unpopular persuade people, and in the end, it does change hearts and minds. I'll open it up totally. Ooh, better do it now. For 2006, I think progress is being made, but I don't think we're there yet. I think on certainly like the gay marriage issue in Minnesota, it's changing, but I think this year, I think it's going to be kind of a wash in most places. And 2 years from now, if somebody came in there for a Constitution Amendment on gay marriage, I think it would be a big negative in most of the state. And I think it's changing that quickly. the media is still going to turn to Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and Jim Dobson. And what I'd argue is their scary views on environment. The world is coming to an end very soon anyhow. Why do we have to protect the planet? Or even some of their Middle Eastern politics about, maybe we can hasten the second coming by making certain things happen in the geopolitical world. But I do think that the public at large, the media, and politicians have seen some movement on this in the last year or two, which is, if anything, it's at a minimum, it's healthy to have a true discussion of these issues. But moral value voters, I've always taken my faith very seriously, and I do see, unlike some people who have similar political philosophy, we got to keep religion and politics separate. Well, I don't see myself as, people come to Holden, don't come to Holden because Sunday morning we go to church and the rest of the week we do whatever we want. We see it as part of who we are in our faith. And if something's part of your, I've always wondered how, if something's part of your faith, part of who your core being, how do you make your political decisions outside of that? And there's a difference between trying to say, we're going to impose our beliefs on you. We're going to make you live according to our wills. The Taliban was very good at that. There's some people in American politics who would like a similar thing with a Christian or their form of Christian belief. But I think most of the world isn't that way, and most of the public is willing to move beyond that. Anyway.
Move forward and try and change to discuss other moral values. Helping people move from poverty into
right.
It seems to me that our country has framed the discussion that that's going to be government, and the government is bad, so therefore we don't have to rule it, we don't want to talk about it. It seems like, how do we move off of that discussion?
The government is evil, kind of thing. It's been done very effectively. Kathy was talking this morning about how science is being under attack by a certain religious philosophy, and one of the, I think it was your comment, about how what I'm talking about tomorrow, about how business community is attacking science for economic and political gain. It's not the religious community that's got all the money to make this happen. It's in many cases, in a whole range of these issues, certain economic interests are funding a whole lot of things to change the agenda. And I always thought it was back to Ronald Reagan in the early 80s when government is the enemy. At that time he had control of both houses of Congress, and not both houses of Congress. He had a working majority in the House and a real majority in the Senate himself, and was running his agenda more effectively than any president I can think of since FDR, getting his way. And he's saying, government's the enemy. I thought, he is the government. It's very much, I worked for an insurance company at that time, and I remember Reagan's tax reform of 1985, I guess it was, came in. It was a certain type of insurance company that was tax exempt, and his tax reform was reasonably, responsibly, I thought, eliminating that tax break for them. And they came in, it was a very conservative organization, lots of Republican support for Ray Reagan was their hero, and here he was taking away their most important tax policy issue they could think of. So who was it? They gave talks to all the staff there, why we should write letters to the White House and the Congress saying, don't do this, don't pass this part of Reagan's tax reform. And the explanation they gave us in the little talk I heard was, it was holdover liberals in the Treasury Department. If there were any holdover liberals, they were well hidden. But it was, they couldn't envision that their leader would do something like that to them. And again, they've been very effectively at selling government as evil. We had a group of religious leaders in Minnesota do a thing on support for the poor about 2 years ago, and one of my colleagues who was just elected 4 years ago wrote a letter, Dear Irreligious Community, an open letter to the people who wrote the open letter to us. And he talked about how anti-Christian their views were because the Bible talks about charitable giving. That means us, not government deciding for us. I thought, he believes it. He's very sincere about it. I always thought the Bible doesn't tell us that we're supposed to work to help the poor by giving money to them, and if that doesn't take care of it, well, the heck with them. Bible doesn't tell us the government should take care of them, and if that's not good enough, we shouldn't help. Bible says take care of the poor any way you can. And I was going to say the Christian right has been very effective at selling that. I don't think there's any simple way to do it. I think the main thing is you have to speak out. I wrote a column on my way out here that talking about why taxes, we've been told taxes are, well, taxes are certainly evil. They take away money from people, money they could use to support themselves, and it's destroying the economy, and high-tax states are just driving business out to low-tax states. And I just took the statistics from recent year, the most recent numbers I could get, and it just so happens that New York, the highest tax state, has sixth highest per capita income after taxes. Connecticut, I think, was number two in highest taxes, and they were highest rated in terms of income after taxes. It just so happens that all five of the highest tax states are in the top 10 in income remaining after taxes, very successful states. And conversely, Mississippi and Alabama and the low-tax states, even after you take away their minimal taxes, not one of those states came even close to half, came even close to the average per capita income in the country. In other words, higher tax states actually do better economically. Trying to sell that, I mean, I can picture how my opponent pulls quotes out of there saying, Marty's saying you ought to raise taxes. But I think the main frustration I've had is political leadership of people who I agree with are so scared to talk about anything. You don't dare talk about taxes because you know it's a losing issue. You know abortion's a losing issue. You know this is a losing issue, so you don't talk about them. What gets me, though, and I can't figure out, and this is when they absolutely can't figure out, is why an issue like environment, where I chair the Environment Committee, and environment's a very popular issue with the voters, but we can't do that because we'll offend the business community that gives the campaign contributions. And so they duck on that. So it's not a quick thing. You don't change minds that way, but I'd say the public has a responsibility. I'd argue the media has an obligation to be fair on the issues. And I'd say politicians have the biggest obligation of all to speak out where they feel they should.
I saw the results of the old four election. Joaquin is a town of 4,500 that all the precincts are in one place, and the religious right was organized for that election in our community. We had one congregation, the pastor had been working on those two issues all fall, and he had a prayer to go that night all night. He brought 65 of his congregation in when the poll opened, and all 65 voted. Well, I assume they all voted
his way, yeah. Well, it's very, well, we happen to live in the precinct where Northwestern College, the college that was formed by Billy Graham and has gone right wing. I mean, I'm not classifying Billy Graham as a right wing Christian right person. His son, maybe, but he was a little more, he loved every president, he loved people in power, wherever they were. But Northwestern College, it's very, very, very conservative, and it's a sizable school. I always lose my own precinct because they bus kids to the polls. And a few years ago, the election judges in our precinct started, and they follow rules very carefully, but they were very scared to say this because they didn't know if they should. But they finally went up to them and said, if you don't stop hollering out in the polling place, because the van driver would come in and the kids would, who we vote for this office? And 1 year standing, in, I think it was 2002 election, I was standing a long line in our polling place, big crowd, and I was standing behind a student, and he's clearly got his sample ballot, who he's supposed to vote for. And I was trying to get a better view of it. I kind of knew who was on it, and I wasn't on it. But yeah, it's very, very clearly there. That's a very legitimate one, because the churches are, I mean, well, it's enforced in interesting ways. There was an Episcopal priest, I believe, in California last year who's under IRS investigation now because he said something shortly before the 2004 election that was anti-war. He didn't mention presidential candidates. He just was giving a talk about how he thought the war was wrong, and they go after him, and you have other people handing out all kinds of things. Yeah, I think it's a very legitimate issue to challenge, and challenge very aggressively. I don't choose to spend my time on it because it's a fairness issue. I don't think you should have tax exemption if you're going to be advocating for specific candidates. On the other hand, the Catholic Archdiocese in Minnesota decided gay marriage was going to be anti-gay marriage was going to be a strong position of theirs. One of the women who lobbied for them quit because she just thought it was immoral what they were doing. And Catholic bishops have been saying some good things about poverty and so on. But she told me that she saw a lot of the parishes, they had these postcards there, send these in. And they had a big rally. They were instructed to preach from the pulpit about gay marriage. And frankly, I think they have a right to talk about gay marriage from the pulpit and how immoral they think it is, regardless of how wrong I think they are. It comes a different point when they start advocating for candidates and so on.
Yeah,
and that's where you ought to be calling the shots, yeah.
Would the IRS be the one
responsible? IRS at the federal level, state revenue departments or whatever would be appropriate too.
The other issue that really bothered me was Senator Johnson,
this is our state Senate majority leader.
Who he thought was a group of colleagues, fellow pastors, and having this discussion about gay marriage. There was an informant in there.
He had tape recorded what he said, and yeah, got him into a lot of trouble.
Extremely.
Yeah, it was he was commenting on whether there was an actual conversation or not. He said he had talked with some Supreme Court justices and they said, no, of course, is somebody going to challenge the law we have? Because his arguments, we didn't need to amend the Constitution. It's already illegal. Gay marriage is already illegal. And he said he asked some of the justices what they felt about it. And they said, oh, come on, we're not going to take up that issue. And, of course, judges shouldn't be talking about those things. So he kind of backtracked and everything. And our Senate Majority Leader is a Lutheran pastor, actually, who is a storyteller. And I would say he basically, in my mind, he said what he thought the Supreme Court justice, if he didn't have a conversation, what they would have said. You know, if he said, are you guys going to take this up? They'd roll their eyes. I mean, I can tell. Do they want to get into an issue like that? They're not dumb. They don't want to get into the issue. He kind of knew that. He told the story. Anyway, the impact of that at the Capitol was we thought the issue was kind of dead because it was kind of bottled up at the legislature. And then this new wild card, what's going to happen now? The impact of it was realistically that a lot of the rural Democratic-led senators who were so scared of the issue, they were looking for a chance. They voted to keep it off the floor before, saying if it came on the floor, they'd have to vote for it because they'd absolutely be dead in the election because of that. It got to the point where they were upset at the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community for making it be an issue. Not that they want it to be one, but because the community exists, therefore it was going to become an issue. And I think some of my colleagues were resentful that they existed because it meant we had to deal with the issue. And it came to one where after that case where this minister clandestinely taped him and started using it right at the key time during the session against him, publicized by the Republican Party, who they went to, not the media, they went to the Republican Party with it. Anyway, he took that as an issue, and people started saying, you know, if his colleagues, I think, were saying, if these guys would destroy this good man, he's a minister, he's a decent guy, they're going to destroy his entire career over this thing. They kind of locked arms and said, I don't care, we're going to defeat this thing. Those guys will stoop to anything. And it turned around from their resentment of it being an issue to one where the folks who were pushing the issue were ones that they thought were, they saw how mean-spirited they were. I mean, just some of the ads I told you, I don't know if you were here at the beginning, I had an ad in the local paper recently with me thumbing, it was a doctored-up ad. My teeth are showing on the top because it was a smiling photo and they have a tongue hanging out. I had to figure out, the newspaper copy I saw was so blurred I couldn't figure out, but it was a cheap Photoshop thing of me thumbing my nose at the voters. And I want to
St. Paul or Minneapolis paper asked me about the ad. I said, yeah, it was nothing illegal about it. It was childish and kind of mean-spirited, but I thought if anything it might backfire, and I think it did. So
I would argue that tape recording might have been legal, but it sure wasn't ethical.
Wasn't. I was, yeah, it's probably not a good way to do things, yeah. Any other, yeah, last. Okay.
Which will go for the insurance, finance, and health, mm-hmm. and employment. And then as soon as it passed, the conservative people wanted to have a recall vote to
recall the elected officials who supported it?
Or
referendum on that. Okay. Yeah.
You shouldn't be able to just take somebody's job away from them without this. So I think that's one of the reasons they didn't get enough referendum signatures. But some of these people realize they haven't got these rights, that's more than. So they think they don't want to marry, they should at least not have a job.
Right. Yeah, we pick up the tab then, yeah. Right. And the fact that they couldn't even get enough votes to put it on a referendum, which is, from my understanding from past years here, that Washington State, it's not that hard to get things on the ballot. But the fact that they didn't suggests that there's big changes in public attitudes. I remember 1983, a member of the Minnesota House brought up a gay rights proposal. 1983, she was openly lesbian, and she talked about how some Christians, and she quoted Leviticus about it's an abomination, and they shall be put to death. And she said that some people believe that we ought to execute people like me for being lesbian. And there was a loud cheer in the crowd from people holding up these Christian signs. I thought, they're saying this woman should die. That's 1983. 1993, we passed the equal rights provision. 2003 or 2004, some of my colleagues, the very conservative right folks, tried to repeal it. Our Senate Judiciary Committee, the chair gave a hearing to this guy. He comes in there, presents it, has all his testimony about how evil and vicious this stuff is. And he's kind of listening and a little bit rolling his eyes at his own witnesses. And by the end, he's kind of sheepishly withdrawing his bill, saying, well, maybe it does need some more work. So 10 years later, even the most extreme folks are, well, he didn't want to bring it up for a vote or anything, not only because it would lose, but because I think he realized it was a little bit extreme. And so 10 years after it was the hottest issue at the legislature then, it's actually now the move to repeal it. Even a lot of people who strongly opposed it at the time, well, they're not sure they like it. They're not going to say they like it, but they're not sure they want to repeal it either. And things are changing even faster with the gay marriage issue. And I think it's partly because of the media. People have role models of people who, Rosie O'Donnell, she got married a few years ago to some woman, didn't she? And the world didn't come to an end, did it? So anyway, I think we're overdue. I'm happy to stay around for a few more minutes and talk. Or we can talk during dinner hour or whatever, but I thank you for your attention. Yeah.